Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Professor David Oppenheimer, author of The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. People with different backgrounds, experiences, and viewpoints benefit from engaging with each other. That's why it's important for people who are insiders to expand their circles to include outsiders and vice versa. The experience of being an outsider is often influenced by age, religion, ethnicity, gender, race, language, disability, economic class, and other forms of identity. Compared with groups that are more homogeneous, diverse groups do a better job at solving problems, making discoveries, teaching and learning from each other, and improving democratic discourse. In his book, The Diversity Principle, Professor Oppenheimer shows how this principle evolved from early 19th century educational reforms in Europe to current debates in U.S. law and public policy. David Oppenheimer is a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, where he serves as faculty co-director of the Pro Bono Program and co-director of the Berkeley Center on Comparative Equality and Anti-Discrimination Law. A global network of more than 1,100 plus scholars, practitioners, and students from six continents working on systemic inequality and discrimination. In addition to his teaching and scholarship, he has a global pro bono practice. He holds a JD from Harvard Law School and has taught in France, Italy, and elsewhere. For more information, you can visit the website www.diversityprinciple.com. Okay, and with that, I'd like to welcome David to the show. Good day, sir.
Good day, Robert, and thank you so much for having me on your wonderful podcast.
You're very welcome. And, you know, the idea of diversity and kind of what's been going on in the world, to me, it's important. I've always been very supportive of diversity, and I was real anxious to be able to have this conversation with you. So, first of all, what inspired you to write this book at this time? I mean, you have quite a volume of reference material in the book.
Well, I thank you. I do think that the book is well-referenced in that the bibliography runs 98 pages, and as a result, my publisher asked me if we could put it on the Berkeley website instead of including it in the book in order to reduce the size and cost of production. And there are over 1,000 endnotes, which take up part of the volume of the book. But that's because there has been such a rich history of this idea that diversity helps us to make better decisions and to see things with greater clarity and greater variety, greater diversity. I've been working adjacent to this idea of diversity since the Supreme Court in 1978 said that diversity was an important value in academic freedom. But it was really about 14 years ago when I expressed some skepticism about how important diversity really is. And a colleague pushed back and she said, you need to do more research before you come to that conclusion, which of course is the job of a professor, is to not form opinions or conclusions without having done deep research. And so that's sort of how I got started on what I thought was an idea that had developed as part of the sort of late civil rights movement in the 1970s And it turns out I was off by 160 years, that it really started with the founding of the first modern research university in 1810 in Berlin, and the recognition that if they included Catholics and Jews in what otherwise would have been a completely Protestant university, they'd be generating more ideas and they would be more successful as a university. And that was the beginning of how this idea evolved into our current diversity policies.
Yeah, I was shocked at how far back that it went. I'm pretty much like your initial thought, maybe the 70s, 60s, you know, maybe even a little bit before that. But to have it go back so far, it was a surprise to me. Now, how would you define diversity?
I would define diversity as difference.
Okay. That was simple.
You probably wanted a longer expression. I mean, the
diversity. Well, I do appreciate the simplicity, you know, but.
But I guess what kind of difference? You know, the diversity principle, which you stated at the beginning of the show, is that if you take people with different backgrounds and experiences, and you put them together, they'll generate more ideas. They'll solve problems better. They'll come up with interesting and innovative solutions. In a science lab, diverse scientific research groups make more significant discoveries. In business, if you have diversity in the board of directors and in the C-suite and the governance of the business, they make more money. In government, if you have more diversity in a government office, they'll come up with more innovative public policy ideas. We do better when we are thinking in a group and the members of the group have different backgrounds and experiences. And that includes, it's not exclusively, but it includes differences in gender, in ethnicity, in race, in age, in religion, in whether we come from rural or urban backgrounds, whether we have disabilities and the kinds of disabilities that we may bring to the discussion. All of these things influence how we see and experience the world, and in turn, the kinds of ideas that we generate when we are in a group trying to solve a problem.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense because each person's life experience brings to the table different points of view, even maybe some actions, past actions that have been positive that they can add to the situation. So it just seems to make sense that it's more productive, you know, as well as giving value to each of the member of the group.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that you pointed to it making sense because, you know, for the first 150 years of this principle, maybe the first 180 years, it was regarded as common sense mixed with political theory. And then when the courts started pointing to diversity as a positive value, scientists started asking, well, is this real? Is this provable? Is this measurable? Is this something that is just some theory of a bunch of lawyers and judges, or is it something that we can test? And the answer has been in thousands now of studies that empirically the diversity principle really works. It is the case that a diverse group of scientists will make more significant discoveries. It is the case that a business with greater diversity in its leadership will make more money. It is the case that in a classroom, if the students have greater diversity, they will generate more ideas and they will come up with more solutions to problems. you know, this is something that's gone from being what we agree is just sort of common sense to something that has been scientifically measured and evaluated empirically.
Yeah. And for scientists and some people who do the logical thinking, you know, to be able to show definitively the positive effect, one would think that it would be embraced, especially if you want to improve either your life, your corporation, or whatever role that you're playing. Right now, we're experiencing some backlash regarding diversity. So can you tell us why that backlash maybe misunderstands what diversity is?
Sure. I mean, the backlash is coming from people who feel threatened by the idea that diversity is a positive value, that it's good for business, that it's good for education, because they're from groups who've been in control. They're from groups who have been able to exclude others. And if they have to be more inclusive, they worry that their influence will be reduced, their opportunities will be reduced. And I think the answer to that is that the value of diversity increases the wealth of our society, increases the pie that we're dividing so significantly that they too will benefit. And I would point to this. In 1964, we passed a breakthrough law that prohibited discrimination based on race, national origin, sex, religion, in employment and in access to public accommodations, restaurants, hotels, public places. Since that time, our country's economy has grown so dramatically, and the reputation of our science and scientists have grown so remarkably, and the reputation and strength of our universities have gone up so dramatically, and the number of people who are receiving a university education has gone up exponentially. And the result of all that is that everyone in our society is wealthier than they were two generations ago. Now, the problem and the, I think, cause of a lot of the pushback is that, and this is my opinion, that our tax policies have relieved the wealthy of having to pay significant taxes and have passed the burden down to the middle class. And the result is that although people are wealthier, they're also having to pay much more, that is most of us, those who are middle class, have to pay much more in taxes than we did before, because we're paying for everyone. We're paying for the rich who don't have to pay for taxes. I'm getting off on a tangent.
Yeah. but that's okay. No, I mean, because, you know, many times the public policy and trends really go back to the dollar. You know, what is happening with money?
Yeah. And I do think that the pushback comes from fear that if we become more inclusive as a society, and if we create more opportunities for women and more opportunities for Black Americans and Hispanic Americans, whites and white men worry that the cost will be paid by them. I mean, this was President Trump a few weeks ago said that the Civil Rights Acts of the 1960s were bad for white men. I don't think that's true. I think that you can demonstrate that they've been good for everyone. But I understand why people worry about scarcity and why people worry that being inclusive will, for them, be exclusive. We'll keep them out. And I think that's the reason for the opposition to diversity. It's not a principled opposition. It's not a diversity doesn't help us make better decisions. It's not the the view that diversity is some way bad for the society as a whole. It's a self-interest objection.
Yeah. You know, and I think a lot of that kind of comes from an idea of a, you know, zero-sum kind of environment that, you know, if one group gains, another group loses, rather than the idea that you could have both groups gain.
Robert, I agree with you completely. I think that was a really, really good way to put it, that there aren't many things in life that are really zero-sum, that really, if I do better, you do worse. The good things in life, in many ways, are those where if I do better, you do better. We're a community.
Yeah, very much. Now, you were mentioning about businesses and corporations. Is it true that diversity once was embraced by conservatives, corporations, and the military?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, the military, the U.S. military, which is, of course, the greatest military, can I say, in the history of the world? I think that's right. I had a friend who used to say in the history of the known universe. So much of the strength of our military in the past generation has come from the fact that there was recognition that expanding the number of people who could be leaders in our military to women and expanding leadership opportunities for Black Americans and Hispanic Americans would make us a stronger country and make our military a stronger military. And so until very recently, the United States military led in efforts to increase diversity. And then companies that also became more diverse, I think in some cases were motivated by politics, but in many cases, we're simply motivated by the bottom line. And whether the leaders of those companies were liberals or conservatives didn't really matter. What mattered is that they felt an obligation to their stockholders. They felt a desire to see a success for themselves and their company. And therefore, they did what worked. And what was working was increasing diversity.
Yeah, and I can see where things change. You know, I mean, you know how sometimes a particular environment may guide people in one direction or another. Now, on your website, you have a link called Postscript, and in it, it's the Trump administration's war on diversity. Now, when I read it, it's indicated that Yale University Press, I believe they're the ones that were the publisher?
That's correct. They're my publisher.
And so tell us how it came about that you, first of all, had this Postscript pre-publication included. And you know, what kind, did you get any resistance from the publisher about this particular topic?
Oh, absolutely not. I had to turn in the final manuscript to the copy editor at the end of January of last year. So a week or so after President Trump's second inauguration. And of course, with President Trump's second inauguration came a series of executive orders and lawsuits and policy changes and the firing of employees, all centered on his opposition to diversity policies and his skepticism about the value of diversity. Some people would put that much more strongly. but again, to trying to be fair. No, mm-hmm. It was more than skepticism, though. It was opposition to the idea that diversity has value.
Yeah.
And so I, in the spring, I said to my editor that there were all these new developments, and I suggested that I put on the website that we were building for the book a postscript that would bring people up to date, so that when they bought the book, as I hope people will, I hope some of your listeners will buy The Diversity Principle, when they purchase the book, they would also be able, or even if they didn't buy the book, I'm not supposed to say that, they would be able to go to the website and see this postscript on what's happened between President Trump's second inauguration in January of 2025 and January 1st of 2026. So they were, the folks at Yale were enthusiastic about it, and I'm actually going to read it aloud in a few hours for the audiobook, which is coming out next month.
Wonderful. That's great. And you know, even though people can get that update from your website, I do recommend that they get the book, because you go into so much detail that it really gives one pause to really think about, you know, where we've come, where we are, and possibly where we're going. And I will say, too, also, as I was going through and reading all of those updates, I was shocked. I know that there is a lot that goes on, and I know he has done quite a bit. But when it is right there in front of you and you can go through the list and see just how active he is in fighting diversity, it just blows my mind. So many of those things I had forgotten about, and some of them I didn't even know had happened.
It wasn't a happy thing to write. I had the help from a group of Berkeley law students and undergraduate students as research assistants, to whom I'm very grateful. And they did a really wonderful job of helping me to pull the material together.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Now, how have the court's recent rulings basically rejected or have changed the thought of intellectual tradition?
So, on the one hand, in 2023, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that diversity, regardless of whether it was a good thing and regardless of whether it has measurable value, could not justify using race in a university's decision about which students or which applicants to admit as students. And so university affirmative action programs that had for 45 years relied on the benefits of diversity as a reason to operate an affirmative action program had to eliminate those programs. So that was a significant legal change with regard to diversity. On the other hand, many of the steps that have been taken by the Trump administration and in various states, with Florida and Texas sort of leading the way, even before President Trump's election in 2024, many of the laws that have passed or many of the policy changes that have been enacted and some of the executive orders that have been issued have either been stayed by the courts pending further review or have been reversed by the courts because they were not in compliance with the current American law. So either in some cases they were unconstitutional, in some cases they violated statutes passed by Congress, in some cases they violated our administrative procedures for how we change laws. And so many of the attempts by the Trump administration to reverse diversity policies have either been temporarily stayed or have been stopped by the courts.
Yeah, and I am glad that branch of the government is looking at the activity in relation to current and existing law. It's encouraging to see that even if it's only just being stayed for a while, there is at least some examining of the issue going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there are many things, on the other hand, that President Trump has done that are not fixable, that can't be undone. And can I briefly tell the story of Dr. Carla Hayden, who was the Librarian of Congress?
Yes, please. Yeah, I liked that story when I read it. Mm-hmm.
So Carla Hayden, a Black woman, grew up in a middle-class neighborhood and loved the library, loved reading, started working as a volunteer in the Chicago Library, reading to autistic children, pursued a degree in library science and then a master's degree, and then ultimately at the University of Chicago, one of the great universities of the world, a PhD, a doctor of philosophy in library science. She was served as a professor of library science and then was appointed the head of the Chicago Public Library and then the Baltimore Public Library. She was the president of the American Librarians Association. And 9 years ago, she was appointed by President Obama to a 10-year term as the Librarian of Congress. And her appointment was confirmed by the Senate. In her eighth year in that position, soon after President Trump's second inauguration, he fired Dr. Hayden. And there was no explanation given in the termination. It was simply an email message. Didn't even call her Dr. Hayden, just said, Carla, we're letting you go. And a serious question as to whether the president had that authority. But put that aside. The question is asked the next day of the president's press secretary, why was the Librarian of Congress fired? And she said, because her support for diversity policies meant that she was putting LGBT books that were inappropriate for children in the children's section of the library. Well, that may sound wrong, except that there is no children's section of the Library of Congress. It's not a lending library. It's a research library. It's a research library for members of Congress and for American adults. You have to be 16 years old to seek their help in doing research, and what they do is research. Again, it's not a lending library. The explanation given was just a bald-faced lie. This was the first woman to ever serve as Librarian of Congress, the first Black person to ever serve as Librarian of Congress, and the firing of her and so many other Black women with high positions in government were just based on fabrications, just based on lies. And I just think it's tragic for our country to lose the service of these remarkable people.
I agree. And when that happened, I was appalled, you know, because you knew that the reasons stated weren't true. And the fact that they even tried to pass it off as some kind of worthy action to be taken is ridiculous. And, you know, and I just can't understand how so many lies can be told without a high majority of Americans thinking that something is wrong in this picture. Wow. Now, what happens to democracy when institutions lose the ability to hear from outsiders? Now, in your book, you talk about insiders and outsiders. So maybe you can talk about, you know, what that is, and then how democracy is affected when not being able to hear from outsiders.
Sure. Well, the idea of insiders and outsiders and people who have privilege and the benefits of privilege and those who don't, those who are included as opposed to those who are excluded in our society, that often means people with disabilities. It often means women, less so than it used to, but still significantly. It often means Black Americans and Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans and American Indians or Native Americans. It may mean immigrants who've recently arrived here. Sometimes it's older people. Sometimes it's people from minority religions. These are all reasons why people are treated as outsiders or excluded, have a harder time accessing the benefits of opportunity in this, the country of enormous opportunity. And so when they are left out and when the group that remains is more homogeneous, the effect is that the decisions that are being made are less well thought through, are less creative, are less successful. And, you know, we live in an extraordinarily successful country, both in terms of our economy and in terms of our self-governance, our democracy. I don't think you can point to a country of this size that has been more successful, that has been wealthier, that has been better at generating wealth, that has been more democratic in the history of the world. We run the risk if we reduce the diversity of in leadership, if we reduce the diversity in decision makers, that we will see our economy falter, that we will see our democracy become less democratic, less representative, and that we will in time fall the way so many other empires have, so many other countries that once were the envy of the world. Right now, we're the envy of the world. Our universities, students from all over the world want to come and study in the U.S. People from all over the world would like to live in the U.S. People all over the world want to do business with U.S. companies. I had a conversation with a friend in Brussels, Belgium, who said that he thought it was unfair that he couldn't vote in American elections, and he can't, because what happens in America is so important to people all over the world. But let's be clear that one of the great, great benefits of being an American, of being an American citizen, is that we get to vote. We get to make these decisions, and our diversity has been so much our strength And it frightens me that we would give that up in terms of what that means in terms of the future for the next generation.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a shame that some people feel that an increasing diversity of the population is something to be thought of as a threat. Now, how did the diversity conversation evolve into DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Good. Let's do this, if I may. Let's start in 1810 with how this idea of diversity moved through our culture and our law. And then in the final portion of that, how diversity policies became DEI policies.
Okay.
Does that work?
That's okay. Perfect.
So 1810, Wilhelm von Humboldt, one of the great Prussian diplomats, philosophers, and scholars, forms the University of Berlin and says, because of the value of diversity, and because my university is going to be one in which people are engaged in the clash of ideas, we're going to allow Catholics and Jews to be part of this university. His ideas get picked up by John Stuart Mill and Mill's wife, Harriet Taylor Mill, and they write a series of books about liberty and society, the most important of which is called On Liberty. And On Liberty begins with a quote from Humboldt about the value of diversity. And On Liberty ties together the importance of listening to minority voices with the value of diversity. The Mills ideas expressed in On Liberty become very important in American First Amendment free speech law, because a then young Harvard Law professor named Felix Frankfurter becomes a mentee to a then elderly Supreme Court justice named Oliver Wendell Holmes. And Frankfurter gets Holmes to reread On Liberty and think about it in terms of the value of diversity and the marketplace of ideas and the value of viewpoint diversity, which the Mills had tied to diversity of religion, diversity of gender, diversity of ethnicity and nationality. And Frankfurter says to Holmes, you need to think about this when you write decisions about the First Amendment. And Holmes agrees. Holmes is persuaded and writes what at first a dissenting opinion, but it becomes the leading opinion in the U.S. on why we allow minority voices to be heard, why we don't suppress the speech of minorities, because of the value of hearing the voices of outsiders and the value of diversity. Those ideas become part of American universities, and Frankfurter, again, now as an older member of the Supreme Court, makes them an essential part of the law of academic freedom. Mm-hmm. And once it's part of the law of academic freedom, a Frankfurter protege, his mentee, Archibald Cox, persuades the Supreme Court that this idea from the First Amendment, from John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill, from Van Humboldt and the University of Berlin, gives colleges and universities the right to make selections of students, which include thinking about race, and gender and ethnicity in order to have the values that come with a diverse student body. Once that becomes part of university education, it spreads into the corporate world, and companies start adopting diversity policies. There's this great article by this professor at the Harvard Business School called Affirming Diversity Instead of Affirmative Action. And he becomes a leading voice in this movement of corporate diversity policies. But beginning in the 21st century, those policies become criticized for emphasizing the value of diversity for everyone, but not focusing on the ways to achieve diversity in terms of racial and gender diversity, and the need to have policies that focus on fairness for women and minorities, that's the equity, and on inclusion of women and minorities through policies that encourage them to become part of the inner circle, to become part, to become insiders instead of outsiders. That's mm-hmm. the inclusion. And so these policies begin to be described as diversity, equity, and inclusion policies.
Wow.
And now I have to
yeah.
stop and breathe.
I'm sure. Yeah, you know, and to me, I'm just fascinated with the evolution of thought and action that diversity has encountered. So now, what do you hope readers will take away from reading The Diversity Principle?
I'm hoping for a few things. One, I'm hoping that people will realize that this is a clear and common sense idea that although at one point it was sort of an observation and a theory about maybe how things work, has become empirically what we know about how things work. And second, that it is an idea with a very deep and long history tied up with the success of American commerce and tied up with American democracy and tied up with the things that have made American universities the greatest universities in the world. So those are the things that I'm hoping people will take away from reading this book.
Yeah. Well, the long and deep history you have well documented, and the footnotes, the numerous footnotes, really will give a reader a path to explore more of the subject that you used in your book.
Well, thank you. I hope that's true.
Yeah, I think it is. anyway, David, this has really been a pleasure to speak with you. And I do recommend your book for anyone who is interested in the idea of diversity at all. Definitely get your book and be able to have a clear understanding the value and benefit of diversity in our society.
Well, thank you, Robert. You're a very good interviewer, and it was a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Professor David Oppenheimer, author of The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. And again, you can find out more by going to the website, www.diversityprinciple.com. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.